This is a talk from bethinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit bethinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a bethinker to hear all about bethinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Now, last week, I began a short series on the subject of epistemology. The good news back then was that it would only be a two-part series. The bad news tonight is that it's now extended to three. Sorry to break it to you like that, guys, but I just had to go straight in there. Anyway, last week we looked at the history of epistemology as it is developed within philosophy. So we did an overview, and it's still there on the whiteboard, an overview of epistemological thought. And I took us through this overview because I wanted to highlight this conflict within epistemological development, a conflict between what I call the triad and the dyad. And that's the main point I wanted to elucidate as we went through this historical overview. Just a short review, the triad has obviously three points in it. It comes out of, there's a triangle. So you've got the subject in the bottom left, object in the bottom right, and you've got ideas at the top. And one of the points I made last week I'm going to develop tonight is that this world of ideas is actually separate from this interlocking system of nature that's taking place right there. So this is part of supernature. And one of the points that I try to bring to light is that within the triad, there's always been epistemological optimism. That is, within this triad, there's always been a sense that we can know the truth. And that ideas here actually bridge the gap which exists between the subject and the object. And that is the main epistemological dilemma. How do you span the gap between subject and object? We talked about that last week. And the fact that this is not a part of supernature enables us to span this gap and bring these two together. And I illustrated how that happened last week. That's the one system, epistemological system. The other we call the dyad because there's only two points within this system, the subject and the object. And reason or ideas is simply part of the interlocking system of nature. It doesn't stand outside. Now, the fact that ideas are actually part of the system always leads in the end to a type of skepticism. That's what the historical overview illustrates. Because your thinking processes are bound up within nature, and therefore you end up only with a subjectivity of knowing, of knowledge. So the fact that this doesn't exist within this, in the end, undermines the knowing process. And I tried to work out last week how this system always leads in the end to skepticism, and we don't close the gap between the subject and the object. Now, one of the main purposes of this series is to argue for the world of ideas, because this is a world which is not popular today, which is rejected by so many, and I am doing this whole series to say that this is so important. We need to retain it, or we need to reclaim it in our thinking, in our lives. For the last 200 years, approximately, this world of ideas has been rejected, and philosophy has been working within the dyad system. For the post-Enlightenment mind, this world of ideas is far too supernatural, far too spiritual. It's not tangible enough. And the Enlightenment mind that likes things tangible, so you can see it working. But last week, I was trying to illustrate what happens when you abandon the triad and this world of ideas and live only within the system. And the point I tried to bring out is that you always end yourself in a terrible mess. And that's where we are today as we come down this line here, the 20th century, Kuhn, Popper, Polanyi, the philosophers of science, who basically showed that there's no such thing as objectivity. When that happened, when objectivity is abandoned altogether, then you're only left with language. And here is the philosophical debate over language. And by the time we get to down here, basically epistemology as a discipline within philosophy is dead. And that's where we are today. Epistemology is dead. That's where modern thinking has brought us. No longer is there any truth to be found. Objectivity is impossible. So we are simply lost today in the language game. We're just caught up in a world of signifiers. We have no real access to the object anymore. It doesn't really exist. And actually, for the last 150, 200 years, philosophy has spent most of its time looking at the processes of knowledge. That's why I spent a little time last week on Kant, who's looking at the process of how we come to know things. And Kant becomes more and more agnostic about the object altogether. Just forget that. Let's look at how we come to know things. So it's a much more selfward focus. And whenever you look at the process of knowledge, you have to talk about language. You're inevitably brought to the whole issue of language, because we need language, signifiers, to access reality, to access the object. And basically, when we're left with a language and we come down to here where the reliability of language is altogether undermined, then epistemology dies. We can't know the truth anymore, so we can't come up with any knowledge, we can't come up with any certainty, so we abandon epistemology altogether. And this cuts now the subject off altogether from the object, from reality. So the knower now is really all that's left within philosophy today. And this has left ontology the only discipline left to philosophy. Ontology looks at the essence of something, at beingness. And ontology traditionally has looked at essence and being outside of the self, but now the ontological focus is all with respect to the self. What am I? What is the essence of me as a person? And you need to notice the transition here. The loss of ideas, the triad is abandoned, led to the loss of metaphysics. Because the dyad is really only interested in the material world, the world above physics, the supernatural world, the world where questions like meaning and significance come in. That's no longer necessary because the world of ideas is gone. So that led to the loss of metaphysics within philosophy. This in turn led to an obsession here with the process of knowing. So philosophy becomes obsessed with epistemology, and this obsession with the process of knowing leads to the death of epistemology itself. Now the only thing is ontology, and as I said, the focus is selfward. What is the essence of me? And this has led within philosophy to a terrible introspection. Philosophy has no real interest anymore in the truth outside of the self. Now the impact of this trend has seeped down to every part of human society. Many of you here tonight may not know almost nothing about formal philosophy. And yet this trend I've just outlined marks you very, very deeply. Because most people today, very, very few people, have any truth questions outside of themselves. Questions which relate to history. Questions which relate to ethics and the big picture. Questions which relate to origins. Where did it come from? Where is it going? As I sit at the head of Labrie tables these days, I don't hear many questions like this. These are truth questions, and by and large, they're disappearing. In fact, I don't think we have many questions anymore, which is part of our problem, as I'm going to show us later. We have very few questions. We've lost our curiosity about reality, about truth, because all that exists now is me. That's the world we live within. And because of this state of affairs, coming out of this historical overview, I'm arguing strongly tonight for the return to the triad, hence my title, Three Cheers for the Triad. Because if we return to the triad, then we are also going to return to the world of ideas. And I believe this may be the key to redressing the terrible situation we find ourselves in today. As I just repeat again, you might not have any formal background in philosophy, but this trend has affected each of you very, very deeply. One other point by way of introduction. To recover this world of ideas may mean overcoming what C.S. Lewis called our chronological snobbery. Chronological snobbery is simply the phenomenon that you think the later you are in history, the more sophisticated you become. That's chronological snobbery. So the idea is that the past is inferior to the present. We are more sophisticated, more knowledgeable than they were in the past. Now, this world of ideas is actually a world that belongs very much to the past. And if we're chronological snobs, we look and we say, that's so naive. It lacks sophistication. And it's funny, today, for so many, despair is sophisticated. That's how a lot of us act. To despair is to be very sophisticated. To be certain of anything is to be very naive. How can you do that? So to return to this world, we have to actually check our chronological snobbery. Because if we believe in this world of ideas, we have to acknowledge that it is possible to know. Truth exists, and there are answers to questions. We actually have questions. right, three things I want to do as we look at the triad tonight. And that's why I've added this extra lecture. I just want to bring more out of this historical overview. Next week, we'll move on to the relationship between faith and reason. But I want to do three things. Firstly, look at the importance of ideas in the triad. Secondly, the place of sin in the triad. And then thirdly, the place of revelation in the triad. Let me begin in this first point, the importance of ideas in the triad. And I want to take a few moments to define ideas as they exist within this triad. We did this a little bit last week in the discussion period. I want to try and flesh that out. Ideas, as they exist in this world, belong to that realm of reality we call supernature. Supernature. That is, it's part of the transcendent supernaturalist realm. And I believe when we really engage with ideas, we are touching the spiritual and the supernatural. To think ideas is a spiritual, pure spiritual activity. Now, it's not unrelated to our humanity, but it's a supernatural activity. And that's why I'm a terrible romantic when it comes to this world. I get the shiver down my spine often when I think about entering this world of ideas. Because as I do this, I'm touching the spiritual realm in a very direct way. Now, we live in a culture, a church culture, where we think we touch the spiritual realm when we speak in tongues. Or we have some dramatic spiritual experience. But I'm saying we have a very deep spiritual experience when we enter this world of ideas. Because this fact that ideas belong to supernature, the world which is above, the realm which is above nature, makes them distinct from the system of nature, from the material. And for C.S. Lewis, this was such a critical insight. He said, quote, "As thinkers, we are cut off from what we think about." There's this distinction between them. In our experience, we do not clearly understand, which is the other side of it. The more lucidly we think, the more we're cut off from reality. And the more deeply we enter into reality, the less we think. Reality. So the more lucidly we think, the more we're cut off from reality. The more deeply we enter into reality, the less we think. So he says the human being, while laughing uproariously, can't think about laughter. And you can't think about pleasure while you're making love to someone. These two are distinct from each other. Ideas and reality are distinct. Thinking and experience. Now, important point here, this distinctiveness between the two, this is a separate world, separate realm of reality from this one here. This distinctiveness doesn't mean that these two are in opposition to each other. And that's where Plato went very, very badly wrong. That's where Plato was bad news. Because Plato actually created a dualism between these two worlds. And he pitted the spiritual and the material against each other. They're at odds with each other. And the spiritual is the higher world that we must try and enter. We need to leave this world and go into this one. But Christianity, which is rooted in the principle of incarnation, would say that thinking about reality, although distinct and separate, these two are actually integrated with each other. That's what incarnation is an integration of things which are different. Creator, creature, integrated in one person. Neither end canceled out. Jesus is still fully God, but he's also fully man. But these two are integrated. The same thing happens between these two worlds. And we were never, ever meant to simply escape into this world of ideas as a flight from the material world. That's Platonic. But because they're distinct from each other, the integration between the two enables us to meaningfully understand reality, the object. So think about laughter. The world of ideas enables us to step back and make coherent sense of the experience of laughter. And that's quite wonderful. Now, I wouldn't want to only live in the world of analyzing laughter in the world of ideas. But if you only laughed, it wouldn't be as meaningful as it could be. Now, this coherence between these two worlds is an epistemological coherence. We can come to a real knowledge because the world of ideas is there, and we can step out and then go back in. But I want now to briefly list the consequences of ideas as they exist in the triad. What's the consequences of this being there? And there are four consequences I want to list. and I do this as briefly as possible. There's so much more than that could be said. Firstly, ideas bring the supernatural into everyday life. The world of ideas brings the supernatural into everyday life. The dyad, as I said a moment ago, tends to be very materialistic. It's part of the empirical tradition, which leaves all knowledge at the level of the sensual, the senses. So you can only truly know what you can access through the senses. That's the dyad. Now, many Christians, especially in the present, operate within the dyad. Now, they were open to the supernatural. You can't be a Christian and not open to the supernatural, but they did something radical here. And they have tended to be what's called thinkers of discontinuity. There's a total line between these two things. There's no connections at all. They're thinkers of discontinuity. And this has led to a very existential theology. Kierkegaard, called the father of existentialism, Karl Barth, was an existential theologian. And basically they said within the dyad that we're locked into this world and we only encounter God in the spiritual when he breaks through. And the stress is totally on a supernatural revelation where God bursts through to come into this world right here, the dyad. And unless God dramatically breaks through, we are earthbound within this dyad. So it makes the encounter a very existential event. Boom, God's broken through. Now he exists. Now within the triad, the encounter with the supernatural is not so existentially orientated to special moments. Because we have constant access to the supernatural realm, primarily through this world of ideas. And this is a purely spiritual activity. When I say purely spiritual, I don't mean cut off from our humanity. But it's a spiritual world. It's to touch the supernatural. And because of this fact right here, it makes one much more open to the supernatural at all moments. Supernature is not far away. It's as close as the world of thought. And you see, it touches ordinary life. It comes so close to the natural. My problem with existential theology is that ultimately it removes God and the supernatural from ordinary existence. You're always looking for encounters. Within the triad, you don't have to look for dramatic encounters. It's right there. It's right here. So the world of ideas leads us to the reality of the supernatural. It actually fascinates me enormously that Lewis was challenged out of his philosophical materialism, he was a materialist, by this fact right here, the first few chapters of Miracles. What led him to a belief in the supernatural? The world of ideas is distinct from the rest of reality. So the consequence is ideas bring the supernatural into everyday, ordinary life experience. Secondly, ideas are so important because they put epistemology on the agenda. Ideas put epistemology on the agenda. Remember how we saw eventually the death of epistemology within the dyad. There, here, as it moves on, we can't ask truth questions because the object here is effectively destroyed in the end. And this has left the self, the subject, as the whole of reality. Now, the world of ideas implies a world which is so much bigger than the self, the spiritual world. And this is a world where truth really exists. If you believe in the world of ideas, you believe in truth. You can think about the truth. You can talk about the truth in that world. And you can set it out in propositions. And you can go between the world of ideas and the real. And you can look for a correspondence between these two things. You set it out in propositions, and then you go into reality and you measure it, looking for the correspondence. Now, that right there actually puts epistemology back on the agenda again. And you start to take truth seriously when you believe in this world, when you enter a world which is bigger than the subject. And I have to say that one of my greatest joys working here at Le Bris is watching this happen to some of you guys. To watch you guys enter a world bigger than yourselves. To see many of you beginning to ask questions, truth questions, maybe for the first time. I'm not calling you down here. This is where we live in history. People don't have questions. They don't have truth questions because epistemology is dead. We believe very strongly at Le Bris in the world of ideas. It drives you guys crazy because we have all these lunch discussions. But as I said at a table recently, I would die for these because it brings us, confronts us with this world. And I've seen over a period of time many people here begin to ask questions for the first time. It puts epistemology back on the agenda. And out of questions here, there comes a deeper connection to reality. Because I believe before we can really touch this, we have to touch this. And that's the greatest joy, seeing people connected to reality again. Because my thesis within my narcissistic material is that the subject is completely cut off from the object now, because this world is missing. When the subject enters this world and believes in truth, they then are able to connect deeply with the object, with reality. The third consequence is this. The world of ideas makes us open to worldview. The world of ideas makes us open to a worldview. Now, although truth is ultimately personal, in case anyone misunderstands me, I don't think truth is ultimately propositional. Truth is personal because Jesus said, I am the truth. This world here always points to something greater than itself, which is God, who is personal. So that's the background to all I want to say here. But this world of idea also allows for truth to be a system. Remember within the dyad, many of these guys along here, Kierkegaard especially, Schleiermacher, Nietzsche, they're reacting against systems. They hate systems. And that's why they abandon this world. But because this world exists, we do believe in systems. The nominalists hated systems. They were reacting against the realists, part of our overview also. And just to say that these models here, which were constructed by the philosophers of science, they didn't actually weren't dealing with systems. They were just dealing with pictures. Simple pictures rather than systems of thought. So this is still in the nominalist tradition, Kuhn, Popper, and Polanyi. If you believe in the world of ideas, you don't have a problem with systems. But there's a very strong trend in theology today to completely reject any worldview dimension to Christianity. There is nothing of the system in Christianity. This is where many people critique Schaeffer. And this is actually reflected in what is known as post-liberalism. Post-liberalism. It's a very popular movement within theology today. It is connected with what's known as narrative theology. And the focus here is all on the fact that Christianity is a story. It's a narrative within history. Quite true. But the Trojan horse in all of this is a complete rejection of all theological systems. And they say there is nothing of the worldview in Christianity. It's simply being connected to history, to the story. But in connecting there and rejecting all systems, they reject theology. You can't say you believe in the inspiration of Scripture. That's just part of a system. We're just connected to history. They don't believe in the world of ideas. But if we really do believe in the world of ideas, we won't have a problem with a worldview. And within the world of thought up here in the ideas frame, it is quite legitimate to make a system of ideas which then correspond with reality. You don't have a problem with that. And you call this a worldview, the truth. And the propositions of truth which are constructed in this world of thought actually reflect what's going on in reality. Further point to this is the fact that the way we view reality in the world of thought will have a huge impact on the way we exist in reality, as the subject. That's why worldviews are so important. The way we think reality impacts the way we exist in reality. And that's why Paul says in Romans 12, verse 2, that we need to be constantly recovering or renewing our Christian minds. Be transformed by the renewing of your minds. Don't conform to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. And do it so the world of thought up here actually corresponds to the world of being, as reflected in the Bible. Underneath all that, Paul is saying the way you think impacts the way you are, the way you live. And that is why a worldview is so important. That's why all of us need to be philosophers at one level. We need to believe in this world and have a constructed system of thought which corresponds with the Bible, because that's going to impact the way we live. The fourth consequence is this, that ideas enable us to effectively engage in the fight for the kingdom of God. This world of ideas enables us to effectively engage in the fight for the kingdom of God. Let me read some verses from 2 Corinthians chapter 10, starting at verse 3. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. We don't pick up guns and swords and all the rest of it. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. Talk about a world of ideas. Where do we fight? Paul says we enter the world of ideas. That's where we fight. We fight in the world of thought. And I believe that evangelism and mission, as much as anything else, is a fight for the minds of human beings up here. I believe the world of ideas is where real evangelism takes place. And that's why we have to tackle the world of thought in this realm of ideas here. Paul is reminding us in 2 Corinthians 10 that there is a divine power in the weapon of ideas, a divine power to demolish strongholds. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 3 to 5. And again, this is something that we see so often here at LaBrie. We see the divine power in ideas to change lives. And this in a moment of history when ideas have been almost abandoned completely. That's why it shouldn't be. That's why LaBrie is unique in some respects. Because there are some, but not many people who actually take this world very, very seriously. In so much evangelism today, in so much mission, Christ is simply a consumer item. Jesus exists to make the self, the subject, feel good. And there's no connection at all to ideas. And that's why we have to reconnect to ideas again, because this alone will demolish strongholds. It's strong language. It's an incredible weapon, Paul's saying. As an aside here, let me say that the more connected we become to ideas, the more we gain insight into where the stronghold of lies bind us as Christians. If we're really committed to this idea, this world of ideas, we'll say, hang on, the way I'm thinking at the moment isn't as a Christian ought to think. I'm thinking in the wrong way here. And I actually believe this world is incredibly important, not just for evangelism, it's incredibly important for sanctification, for growing in likeness to Christ. It's important, this world, so we don't think like the world. Os Guinness shows that the church, abandoning the world of ideas, has become incredibly worldly. The value system of the world is no different from the world itself. All we have is the God language on top. Why? Because we've abandoned this world. That's one of the chief causes of the church's worldliness. So that's my first point, the importance of ideas within the triad. Secondly, I want to look at the place of sin in the triad. The place of sin in the triad. How has the reality of sin affected this world of ideas? What impact has it had on the epistemological enterprise? Well, philosophers who stand outside Christianity have failed altogether to take sin into account. So Plato, the Stoics, Hegel, had this massive epistemological optimism which didn't reflect the reality of sin. So the connections between all the points of the triangle are all too smooth with these thinkers. And I believe there are also some Christian thinkers who have failed to appreciate the scale of damage which is imposed by sin. And this is those who are overly given to what we call natural theology, that we can reason our way to God and truth in the world of ideas apart from his revelation to us. We'll get back to that in a moment. And when we come to the Bible, we see that Romans 1 is very clear that sin has done great damage in the world of ideas. Let me read you some verses. Just listen. Romans 1, 18 to 23. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, supernatural, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. There's a connection between this and this. It's obvious, Paul's saying. So that men are without excuse. For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal men and birds and animals and reptiles. We haven't time to go into a detailed exegesis of that passage, but Paul is reminding us here that what ought to be smooth in the world of ideas, because it's so obvious, that's his point, has actually become very murky because of sin, to the point that we actually suppress what's obvious. We can't think straight anymore in this world. It's obvious, but we suppress it. And he says in verse 21 that in the world of ideas we now have futile and foolish thoughts. Damning indictment in our thinking in the world of ideas. So what is obvious at one level, i.e. the invisible, the spiritual reality which is manifest within the material, the object? We can't see it anymore. And we suffer from what we might call epistemic blindness. And that's why C.S. Lewis's insight that this world is proof of the supernatural was such an obvious one, but he just couldn't see it before. Because we suppress the truth. We can't see it. We have epistemic blindness. Now, Paul is saying here that this epistemic blindness is actually a manifestation or a revelation of God's wrath. And that's quite a heavy thought. It's God's judgment on us. So ideas no longer work as they should, Paul's saying. There ought to be these smooth connections in the triad so we could know the truth easily. That's the reality of it. But because of sin, now we're in the dark up here. And this is God's judgment upon us. The judgment is blindness. We can no longer see the obvious. Now this reminds us, and Fudge pointed this out last week, that sin doesn't belong in the triad. It doesn't belong there. It's the problem. Sin here is a distortion of God's original blueprint, that the connections all be smooth, and we have no knowledge problems. But because of sin, we now have this epistemic blindness. Knowledge is not straightforward. That's why we have endless Labrie discussions. It's not straightforward. Now, we haven't said, in my last point, that the world of ideas no longer exists. We've simply said that we no longer deal with the truth that's there as we ought to. We suppress the obvious. That's our epistemic dilemma. And that's all I want to say on this point, the place of sin in the triad. My last point is this, the place of revelation in the triad. The place of revelation in the triad. Now, amongst Christian thinkers, theologians, there have always been two emphases with respect to the issue of revelation. We have general revelation and we have special revelation. I think all theological systems, some would want to call it a system, but all believe in these two types of revelation. General revelation is a focus on how God has made himself known through our experience of life and reality. That's general revelation. It looks at what can be known about God through his creation. The subject can come to the object and understand something about God simply by moving across that line with the world of ideas. And the object for general revelation is simply a book that has lots of signifiers in it that point to God. General revelation, our normal experience of life and reality. But then there's special revelation. And this focuses on how God has made himself known by intruding into his creation in an extraordinary way, in manner. For instance, the revelation of God in the Bible. God speaks from the outside in. And then in the coming of Jesus Christ, the ultimate special revelation, if I can put it like that. God comes from the outside into creation to reveal himself to us. So the point is, the revelation comes from the outside, and it tells us what we could never know for ourselves. So those are the two different types of revelation. Now, Christians have always acknowledged both of these. But within the various streams of theology, there's always been an accent or a stress on one or the other of these two. And out of the different accents or stresses, there has come much debate right through the history of theology in the church. General revelation is starting with what's before you, our experience of life and reality, and from that, coming to a knowledge of truth in God. Special revelation, it comes from the outside. Now, by and large, those who've worked within the dyad have tended to stress special revelation. That's where the accent has been. For those in the dyad, we are locked into the system of nature, and until God breaks through, there is no truth. Remember, those who work within this are epistemologically pessimistic. And many of these have been these thinkers of discontinuity that I talked about a moment ago. These have tended to ignore completely the object. We can't close the gap there. So there's no way you can use this to come to the knowledge of God. And, of course, they deny the world of ideas. This doesn't exist. So that just leaves the subject and this dramatic revelation from outside of the system. That's why it's this that's tended to stress special revelation. All you have is the subject and the possibility of something coming from the outside. Now, in its best form, this is left one with a very high view of the Bible and a deep distrust of human reason. And that's good. But, there's a Trojan horse here. All too often, this has ended up as a form of existential theology. And the focus is all about this encounter with special revelation that comes from the outside. And this leads in turn to something which is highly subjective. It's a downplaying of the rational. It's all about experience. And actually this, in its worst manifestations, is the most irrational type of theology. Barth was very rational, but many of the followers of Barth, who followed the Barthian way, who were committed to the existential way, became highly irrational. That's the problem with this system and its very extreme focus on special revelation only. Now, those within the triad have tended to lay more emphasis on general revelation, and they've been much more optimistic in terms of their epistemology. They say there are real connections between the points of the triangle. The object can lead us to the truth because of the existence of ideas which enable us to really look at the way things are. Now, the good thing with this is that it roots theology in life and reality. This is so cut off from real life in some ways. It's all about the encounter. But here, you don't have to wait for some existential encounter. It's right there in front of us, if we'd only have eyes to see and ears to hear. The weakness of this particular system with respect to its focus on general revelation is that it ignores the content of Romans 1, which says that we have this epistemic blindness. And this has often devalued the necessity of the Bible to the issue of truth. And that's where this has often led to a form of liberalism. Actually, both of these in the end up in a type of liberalism. And it almost seems, for those who stand within this world here, the focus on general revelation, that it's quite possible to figure out all the truth you need to know and figure out God apart from the Bible, apart from special revelation. And for them, it's just wonderful that we have this special revelation which kind of backs up what we learn through this. Now I want to ask, what is the relationship between these two forms of revelation? What's the relationship between them? I think all of us acknowledge that they both exist in one form or other. What's the relationship between the two of them? Well, having established that there is the problem of epistemic blindness, we must also say that this does not make the world of ideas and the object irrelevant. And this means that we ought to take general revelation very seriously, which this system doesn't. You see, general revelation tells us that we have to take reality seriously because it points to God. And as we bump up against reality, as we confront it, something begins to happen. And the value of general revelation is this. It forces us to the basic questions of existence. So within this system, we say that this whole thing is important, although there's this epistemic blindness here. And as the subject bumps up against the object, boom, within the world of ideas, we face questions of existence. And these questions come out of the triad, the connections between these three here. Now, these questions that come out of general revelation are actually questions which God is asking of each of us. And we can't avoid these questions. We keep bumping into them as we stand in the triad, as we deal with reality as it is, as we deal with the world of ideas as it is, we face these questions. We can't ignore them. And that's why I believe that those who operate within the triad are closer to God than those who operate within the dyad, because they have to face the questions of existence. And these are vitally important. Now, these questions of existence that we face in general revelation are limited in number. There's not many. You go to any culture in the world, and you'll see a parallel in terms of the questions of existence, because we all face the same reality, the givens of reality. Let me very briefly list these questions. And I believe if we were awake to the world of ideas and to the object, we would all be asking these questions. This would fill all our lunchtime discussions. If we believe that general revelation makes us, forces us to ask the questions, that it's actually God asking questions of us. Questions like, what is the world? Reality, the world. What is the human being? thirdly, what is the ultimate background of our world? What about its origin? What about the causal links that lead to this thing in front of us, this world? Four, where do moral norms come from? Where do we find a basis for our ethics? That's a question of existence. We can't ignore that if we're within this world here. Fifthly, what's the relationship between fate and responsibility? Or a shorter way of putting it, what is history? We're all caught up in history. What is it? It's a basic question of existence. Fate. Sixthly, what's wrong with the world? If you're bumping up against this and you're bumping up against this, you can't avoid it. Something's wrong. You see it in your newspaper every day. You ask that basic question of existence. What is wrong with the world? Seventh, what is death? Basic question of existence. People die. What is it? What's going on there? And eighth, is there meaning in life? Here I am as a human being in this world trying to make sense of these basic questions of existence. Is there meaning to all of this? There may be a few more, a few less, but I would say those are the eight questions, basic questions of existence. There's no more, really. That encapsulates the whole picture. I could probably boil those down even to four if I wanted to, or three. That's what general revelation faces us with, the basic questions of existence. And they're unavoidable. If we're really bumping up against this, we're not narcissistic, where this becomes everything, and we believe in this. And I believe religion, in whatever form it takes, is the human answer to the basic question of existence. As we operate within the triad, we bump up against all these things. Unavoidable, and religion is the answer. There's endless debate on what is religion. This is what religion is for me. It comes out of general revelation. Now, what I want you to see here is this. Within the triad, the epistemological enterprise is not primarily about answers, it's about questions. That's the main point. And this is the value of general revelation. It gets us to ask the basic questions of existence. And it's actually the way that God questions us. And this is so important because these questions that come out of being tied up in this, these questions are fundamental to Christianity. You know, we will never find answers until we're asking questions. And if we're not asking questions, we won't find the answer. And without questions, we will never find God. If you're not asking questions, you cannot become a Christian. Because the fundamental and primary question is this: what do I have to do to be saved? It's a question. If you never ask that, you'll never become a Christian. No questions, no answers. No Christianity, no salvation. And that's why I tremble when I see so many of you with no questions today. You don't have any questions. Because our questions are so necessary to move us on to the point we can find an answer. If we have no questions, we're just static. We're not searching for anything. Pascal, Blaise Pascal said in his Ponzi's, passionate truth-seeking is the one thing needed to come to Christ. The Lord says, you will find me when? When you seek me with all your heart, passionate truth-seeking, then you'll find me. And that's what questions do to us. They get us seeking. Dick Kies, my colleague at Southborough Labrie, is actually going through the Gospel looking at the apologetics of Jesus. All of Jesus' apologetics were tied up in questions. Very interesting. What does a question do? Most of Jesus' questions disturbed people. It shook them up. It made them restless. It got them into questioning mode. It got them on the search. I'm saying general revelation does that. God asks questions of us through this triad. These are God's disturbing questions for us. What is the world? What does it mean to be human? Where did it come from? Where are moral norms from? Why is it wrong? What about death? What about history? What about meaning? This forces us to ask questions. Now, what we see here is that the epistemological quest isn't so much about questions, as I said, it's about answers. What we see is that the epistemological quest is as much about questions as it is about answers. That's a good thing for you to keep in mind while you're here. So much like LaBrie. LaBrie has this little mantra, honest answers to honest questions. I think it's much more like, give me one question and I'll send you away with 20. Because questions are so important. And actually, epistemology is about being questioned. Someone questions you, reality, existence questions you, and God is behind that. We so often suppose that we are controlling the agenda in the epistemological quest. We're determining the questions. No, we're not. In the triad, general revelation is questioning us. We are not in control. And that, for most of us here, is a very important lesson because it's all about control for us. This shakes us up. We lose control. Existence asks questions of us. We don't have control of the questions, let alone the answers. That's what general revelation does. That's why it's so important. What then about special revelation? Well, special revelation is God's answers to the questions that come out of our engagement with reality. The questions he asks of our human existence. I've said general revelation are the questions God asks of us. Special revelation is his answer. Isn't that unfair? He asks the questions, he gives the answers. Welcome to reality. That's exactly how it is. He asks the questions, he gives the answers. It's a holy, God-shaped enterprise. That's what epistemology is. All of this has the human being in the driving seat. They're asking the questions. But reality is about God asking the questions and God giving the answers. And the fact is, in the Bible alone and in Jesus Christ, can we find a full answer to the questions raised by general revelation. And unless we bow to this answer, the answer of special revelation, we continue in our epistemic blindness. That's the fact, according to the Bible. Now, this is all of our choice. No one's being forced to anything here. God asks the question, I said, and God gives the answer. But he won't force us at either end. He asks the questions, but we don't have to do anything with them. We can ignore them and say, I don't want to ask any questions of myself. That's fine, you can do that. It doesn't force you either to receive the answer. But the Bible is unapologetic. God asks the questions, God gives the answers, and it's your choice what you do with that. So my point is, within the triad, we are open to being questioned, and we're also open to receiving answers, and to receiving answers in the world of ideas, because this world is open to something from the outside, special revelation. And we're open to an answer that actually corresponds with reality, corresponds to the subject. We're open to a system of thought that makes sense of the whole of reality. We're open to a worldview that is really true, because within this, we're epistemologically optimistic. Now I want to finish with this question. How can we be certain of the answer which is given by the Bible? Because revelation, special revelation, demands a certain kind of faith. How can we be certain of the answer which the Bible gives to the problem of our epistemic blindness? And the answer the Bible gives to the questions which are raised through general revelation? And where is the proof that this really is the answer? And that leads to the subject of my next lecture, where we're going to look then at the relationship between faith and reason, and how this relates to the issue of certainty. Right, let me leave it there for this evening.